Hello and welcome to the Mixed Media Podcast for Wednesday, May 13th. I'm Chris Wagner, culture critic for the Dallas Morning News, and in case you didn't notice, I have a cold. I'm joined in the studio by Christopher Wynn, deputy editor for FD, the style magazine of the Dallas Morning News. Hello, Mr. Wynn.
Hi, Chris. I think you sound pretty good.
Thanks. So far, so good. Also joining us today is guest host Lauren Smart, arts and culture editor for the Dallas Observer. Hello, Lauren.
Hello.
On today's show, Dallas writer Sarah Heppala is here to talk about her forthcoming memoir, Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. Then physician and Dallas Morning News staff writer Seema Yasmin discusses her new story about the trend in so-called intimate plastic surgery for women. Is it just another cosmetic operation or an example of how society and the media are preying on women's insecurities? Finally, grab the popcorn. We'll preview the latest crop of summer blockbuster films and talk about Hollywood's continued obsession with sequels and reboots, otherwise the bane of my existence. But before we get started, Christopher has a quick update from last week's show, which I believe involves kangaroos.
It does. So last week we had Merritt Tears talking about her novel that she's working on about kangaroos. The official update on that, I wanted to explain a little more. As she told Kirkus Reviews, it's a dystopian fiction featuring kangaroos. It has to do with the liberation of women and the key role that the reproductive capacity plays in keeping women subjugated and second class. So the main character in the book is a female geneticist who outsources her pregnancy to a kangaroo.
Why didn't she tell us that?
I
was going to ask her if it was a children's book, so I'm glad you found out.
I just want to predict now it's going to be a movie. I think Spike Jones... It's true. It's happening. I can just feel it. I think Spike Jonze is going to direct it. It's going to have a weird title like Pouch. And I think Tilda Swinton would be perfect as the female geneticist.
So real kangaroos or animated?
I'm going to go live, 3D live action.
Okay.
That is the kangaroo prologue to the Mixed Media Podcast. And now, let's get this started. Sarah Heppala lives in Dallas and is the personal essays editor at Salon.com. She's also written the Smart Blonde column for D Magazine, and 10 years ago, she served as music editor for the Dallas Observer. Her freelance writing has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The New Republic, and Slate. Next month, her debut book will be published, a revealing memoir entitled Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Sarah, I have a question for you. The title of the book is Blackout, and an interesting moment for me was that I thought I knew what that meant. I thought it meant that you were literally blacking out, didn't know what was happening, and I was surprised to learn that's not what you're talking about. Can you explain what that is?
Yes. So that is a very common misconception. People conflate blacking out with passing out. A blackout is when you drink so much that your long-term memory shuts down, and you can still laugh and talk and walk, but later you won't have any memory of it. So it's a very freaky thing. It's a walking amnesia.
And it's really hard to say what it's like because you're not really there, right? You can say what it's like right beforehand and what it's like right afterwards.
I can tell you what it feels like to wake up and be told by a friend that you did something that you didn't know you'd done. A lot of the experience around a blackout is morning after experience, because what happens is you're hanging out with your friends and then someone says, hey, do you remember when you did X? And you're like, no, I don't remember when I did X. And the feeling of wrongness that happens in your body when you realize that you've been doing things and you have no memory of them. It's really hard to explain this to people who haven't experienced a blackout, but it introduces this element of doubt in your own narrative. Like, you just don't know what you did the night before. And when I started realizing that I would have blackouts, and I had them, the more I drank, the more frequently I had them, I would wake up and the first question was, what did I do? You start looking at people's faces for clues. If somebody's mad at you, you start to think you might have said something that you don't remember. There's all these clues. Like, your whole apartment becomes all these data sets, you know, where it's like, why is the pizza box right there? I don't remember a pizza box. Where did the pizza box come from? It feels like somebody broke into your house and, you know, rearranged your furniture, right. But you're the one that did it.
I love that in the book you joked about it being like CSI Hangover, where you sort of have to piece together what happened the night before. before.
I always used to make that joke, and all my other heavy drinking friends would laugh really hard because they were like, that is what it is. You wake up and you're like, what happened here? It's CSI hangover. You know, you're taking all the clues from around your apartment. You're looking, I would always look at the receipts in my purse, you know, and you know when you sign those credit card bills and your signature just looks like an EKG or something, you know, just right. Like, what, who signed that? Like, where was it? What is this bar? I didn't go to the Upper East Side last night. Like, what, where did this come from? So, yeah, it is, you have to kind of do what I call detective work on your own life.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, I mean, this book itself, is this the detective work of you going backwards into that part of your life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the detective work on your own life had a double meaning because the act of sobriety is also kind of excavating the past and figuring out who you were. You know, a lot of people that drink like I did, they tell themselves certain stories. I told myself that I was really funny and I was really great to hang out with and I was really sexy and everybody loved that. And then you start to realize that the reality of your... The reality of me was quite different. And then in actually writing the story itself, I was having to do a certain amount of detective work, not just talking to friends, you know, trying to figure out what happened on certain nights.
And in some cases, that was a really frightening... talk a little bit, if you can, about the opening scene of the book, which is...
So the opening scene of the book is the weirdest blackout I ever had, which is that I came to during a blackout, which is not very common. Normally you wake up and then you're like, oh, I lost time. But every once in a while, you'll kind of like get booted back online. So I came to and I was having sex with somebody in a Paris hotel room. And
oh my
I didn't
God.
And yeah. I didn't know who he was. And I didn't know how we'd met, and I didn't know where he came from, and I was on top. I mean, this is like one of those weird, awkward details, but it's like I was on top of him, so I was like, I think I'm liking this. And
you were participating, in other words.
Yeah, it wasn't happening to me. I seemed to be an active agent in this sexual experience. And just like when, you know, when you trip on the stairs and you're like, I'm cool, everything's cool. Mm-hmm. It was that bracing, like, I know what's going on. I'm just going to keep going with this. Mm-hmm. And so I eventually got out of that hotel room, but then I lost my purse, and there's this long sort of dark night of the soul that happens that becomes a chapter later in the book. When I, you know, years later, I decided to go back to Paris and kind of try to follow the trail of string that was that night to see what I could find out about it. Mm. So that was another part of the detective work.
I think a lot of people know what that feels like, that moment of kind of waking up from something and not remembering it. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to put it in a book?
Well, there's so many layers to that question. I mean, I think the reason that I wanted to write a book was because, well, the truth is I'd wanted to write a book since the time that I was 13 or a kid. And I was always that your friend that was going to write a book one day.
Yeah.
And I would always go out with my drinking friends and talk about how we were going to, you know, these were our book ideas. And I never wrote a book. And when I finally got sober and I was so miserable and I thought that my life was over, the idea of writing a book became very appealing to me because it was something I could actually do in sobriety. So then once you decide that you're going to write a book, well, how can you write a book that's different than all the other recovery memoirs that are out there?
I was going to ask you about that because the addiction, you know, the addiction memoir has definitely...
It's a voluminous category. Right. And when you tell people that you are writing a recovery memoir, a very common reaction would be the roll of the eyes or the deep sigh.
Right.
Or the, we don't need another one of those. And so if you're, which, you know, always bothered me because to me, great storytelling is great storytelling.
Right.
That's like saying we don't need another love story. It just doesn't make sense to me. But it did mean that I had a higher burden of telling a story that was different. And, you know, whenever when I'm writing a story, I kind of think, what is the story that I can tell that no one else can? Mm-hmm. And the one that I knew better than anything was drinking. And the part of drinking that I knew better than all my other drinking friends was blackout, the experience of waking up and not knowing what I had done the night before. And I also, Chelsea Handler was really big at the time.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I would see all these stories about women's drinking that were like, ha, 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 I woke up with a midget. And it was like... okay, I know that's funny,
right.
But I've had my own version of that story, and I think there's so much complexity underneath it that the jokes and all that stuff was kind of masking and covering up, and it had become kind of cartoonish charade or shtick or whatever, and I was interested at getting at the feelings and the terror underneath of that.
Well, there's a certain amount of privilege that's required to laugh at something like that. Not taking your own life so seriously.
Yeah, well, I mean, they have that saying of, like, comedy is tragedy plus time, right?
Right.
So
yeah.
So privilege is the time in between. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I was always making jokes about my blackouts. I mean, you know, I tell a story. This is actually in a personal essay I wrote about waking up in a dog bed in someone else's house. And that was a mortifying experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was just, like, not triumphant. Mm-hmm. And when I woke up, it was somebody else's house, and I said, don't ever tell anybody about this. And he was like, I won't, don't worry. And then that day at the staff meeting, I was like, you guys, I woke up in a dog bed.
Right.
And that made me feel like I was in control of my narrative. It made me feel like I wasn't the butt of the joke. I was the person telling the joke. I was the entertaining storyteller. So when you are the one in charge of the punchlines, it can be a feeling of power.
Right. You grew up in Dallas and Park Cities.
Oh, my gosh, I did.
And in some ways.
The bubble.
Talk to us about that. And that's, you began drinking very young. I wonder if you could talk about kind of your evolution in Dallas and sort of those first few drinks.
Well, and there's two parts of that story. And one part is the part of growing up in the Park Cities. And, you know, one of the reasons that my Dallas story is important to my drinking story is that when I was a kid, you know, being in the Park Cities was kind of, it was the first time that I really felt like I didn't belong. Mm-hmm. You know, it was this powerful feeling of not being a part of that. My parents were Yankee liberals that my dad had come to Dallas to work for the EPA. We didn't belong. We didn't know anybody. And there was that feeling of, what are we doing here? And they chose the school system, the best school system. Mm-hmm. And we rented a small house. And they just had no idea. And so I was brought up around a lot of wanting and a lot of looking at other people and comparing myself to their lives. I didn't have what they had. And I had that feeling of your nose pressed up against the window pane mm-hmm. of someone else's life. You know, I mean, I had such skewed perspective, too. It's just like, why can't I have a Louis Vuitton purse at the age of 12?
Right.
Why aren't we driving the new Mercedes?
Right.
You know, this is horrible that we're driving a station wagon. This is the worst. I think that I was desperate to be more than to have more than I had been given. So, you know, you asked about early drinking, and, mm-hmm. and I think that the part about early drinking is, first of all, I had my first sips of beer when I was 4 years old. I mean, my dad just kind of gave me a few sips of beer, and I think, you know, most kids are supposed to just go like, gross, this is disgusting. Right. And I was like, what is that magic elixir? And I loved the feeling of it, and it became this little sneaky thing that I did that my parents didn't know about. And this horrifies my parents. They are so freaked out by this story that I would go, my mom used to leave her Pearl Light in the fridge half drunk, which tells you that's how much of a non-alcoholic she was.
Right.
She wouldn't even finish a beer in one sitting.
A can of beer.
And so she would leave her Pearl Light, and then when she was gone, I would sneak it back out, and I would take a couple slugs, and then I would spin around the living room, and it was the greatest feeling in the world.
In fact, can I compliment your beer? Your writing about drinking a beer is so phenomenal. I have a piece here. Quote, but nothing was as good as the beer, the fizz, the left hook of it, that wicked kapow. Another one I loved about, you know, popping the can open with a it sprayed like the lightest afternoon shower on my face. The zap with the tongue, the way my glands squeezed like a fist. I knew how to sip and I knew how to glug. I mean, you can.
Well, thank you. And I think what those are, those are love stories. You know, those are love letters. You know, that's first love. You know, and I was a lonely kid and I didn't have a lot of friends and I didn't belong. And that was love.
Sarah, we want to have you read a little bit from the book as well. And that's actually a good lead in. This is a passage from Blackout, which kind of gets into why you drank and what the allure and the love was.
The need to hold on to booze was primal. Drinking had saved me. When I was a child trapped in loneliness, it gave me escape. When I was a teenager crippled by self-consciousness, it gave me power. When I was a young woman unsure of her worth, it gave me courage. When I was lost, it gave me the path. That way toward the next drink and everywhere it leads you. When I triumphed, it celebrated with me. When I cried, it comforted me. And even in the end, when I was tortured by all that it had done to me, it gave me oblivion. Quitting is often an accumulation, not caused by a single act, but a thousand. Drops fill the bucket until one day the bucket tips.
So in the end, was it more difficult to write about the drinking or about that tipping, about the quitting, about sobriety?
Well, I think one of the reasons that it's hard to write about the quitting is because everybody expects you to have this one revelatory moment that hits you like lightning out of the sky, and they expect that, and it didn't happen. It didn't happen in my own life. I've heard many other stories of where it didn't happen to other people either. The lightning bolt, the funny thing about lightning bolts is they hit you all the time. You know, if you've ever been in a bad relationship, you know, every time, every, you know, week, you're like, this is a horrible relationship. I've got to get out of this. But 2 days later, you're like, do I really, though? So the lightning bolts strike. It's just that they don't stick. Mm-hmm. And so why was it that that one day I quit and all these other times before I didn't? And actually, that's one of the biggest mysteries of my sobriety. And this is true for a lot of people. You know, why was it that time that the quitting stuck? And I don't really know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm. As someone who's sober, I can say that I think you really nailed just the anxiety and confusion of that early part of not drinking, where you're just like, what do I do now?
It is the worst. Where do I put my hands? Like, it's like everything. Like, how do I sit in this chair? You wouldn't think that that would inform every one of your behaviors, but it did, because it was what I did with friends, and it was what I did with people I was dating, and it was what I did when I was bored, and it was what I did with colleagues. Every sort of emotion that I could have, I put booze on the end of it. And so without that, I just didn't know how to be in the world anymore. Really simple interactions would unmoor me.
How long ago are we talking?
I quit drinking. It'll be 5 years in June.
What are some like unexpected positive ways that your life has changed?
Well, I wrote this book.
Well,
hey.
I think one of the things that I realized was that all the things I had been drinking toward, I got in sobriety. So in other words, I wanted to be stronger, and I wanted to be smarter and faster and better and braver. But I really couldn't do that when I was needing to have a cocktail in my hand in order to do it. That's a crutch. But when I gave that up, then I could actually fight through the difficult discomfort, the difficult emotions that help you gain that strength, that actual muscle, the muscle that allows you to be the person that you always wanted to drink in order to be. The other thing I have to say is that my friendships all got so much better, you know, because I hadn't really understood the extent to which my drinking had strained my intimate relationships with people. People had stopped. They didn't want to be that close to me anymore. And, you know, I used to think, oh, well, drinking is what I do with my female friends. And a lot of my female friends have been like, no, talking is what we do.
Right.
Drinking was my obsession, but it wasn't the glue that bonded us. You know, that was something totally different.
Mm-hmm. What are you working on next, Sarah, and might it involve kangaroos?
And if not, you need to get on that bandwagon.
I'm thinking about it. I think I might outsource my child rearing. So the book comes out June 23rd. So for the next 6 weeks, I'm really consumed by that. But I do want to work on, I'm already sort of thinking about my next book, and I want it to be a collection of essays. And I want to take the title from a series I did for Nerve called Crying in Restaurants, which is a problem that I have.
We've all done that.
So it'll be a little bit about dating. But, you know, Blackout is really about women. It's about my relationship with women. Mm-hmm. And I wanted Crying in Restaurants to be about my relationships with men.
It strikes me also, this is a good Dallas story because it's a homecoming story as well, because you did a lot of your damage in New York where it's so easy to do so much damage.
Mm-hmm.
And when you decided you changed your life, that you needed to change your life, you came back here. You came back to Dallas. In fact, I think you wrote about that for us, for the Dallas Morning News a few years back.
Yeah, yeah, I did. And it is a homecoming story. And what's meaningful to me is that, you know, I have a line in the book, you know, I grew up in Dallas wondering why.
I love that
which
line.
Was so much a part of my young experience of just like, how did I get here? What was has been done to me? And I need to get out of here. And when I finally did that thing, when I went out to New York and I made my way in the big city, and it crushed me as it crushes many.
Well, and I like that you pointed out that, that some of those things from childhood follow you when you're an adult. You talked about that first job you had where you hung a poster of your desk of Rent when you were, I think it was the Austin.
Yeah, the Austin Chronicle.
Yeah, and somebody kind of walked by and was like, seriously? And you quickly got, you know, there was a social code that we signaled to each other ways in which we are accepted and not accepted. And you replaced it with, like, Blade Runner.
Which,
Blade.
A movie that I have, like, never seen the full way through.
Right.
What?
I know. I don't even get into it, but I think
but
it's...
But then, fast forward to being an adult in New York, and it's the same sort of social code.
I think that, and the through line that you're noticing here is that I was always embarrassed to be the person that I was. I always felt ashamed of who I was, and I had to be more. And that was part of what drinking allowed me to do, was kind of, like, be exponential, you know, be more than I was. And there was this part of, okay, you know what, I'm just this person, and I don't think I don't work in New York, and I need to get back to Texas. And the accepted thing to do would have been to go to Austin. You know, Austin is the cool city. That's the city that everyone knows. Oh, you're in Austin? Oh, well, then it's okay.
Yeah. Oh, and we get it.
We get it, yeah. And then I went to Austin, and I was like, this is really expensive, and everybody's freaked out about real estate, and, you know, it's really hard. Like, I can't drive anywhere. And I came back to Austin, I mean, Dallas, and it was so easy. And I was in East Dallas, which I love so much. And it really felt like, this is kind of corny, but it is true that coming back to Dallas was kind of accepting myself and accepting where I came from. And it was also choosing this place for the first time, instead of this place happening to me.
Right.
And I'm so glad that I mean, I've been here now for 4 years.
Will you stick around and do a tout with us at the end of the show?
I'm excited to tout.
Awesome. Blackout is available next month, June 23rd, to be exact, from Grand Central Publishing. And you can pre-order it on Amazon.com and keep up with Sarah at sarahhepala.com.
Shadow, everything perfectly matches. Touch my plastic face and see what happens. I'm hiding from the world behind.
Dr. Seema Yasmeen is a former disease detective at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, a current professor at the University of Texas at Dallas, and a staff writer for the Dallas Morning News. You may know her for her stellar coverage of the Ebola story last year. This week, she writes about the multi-million dollar spike in quote-unquote intimate plastic surgery procedures, more specifically, vaginal rejuvenation. The piece has already sparked quite the response. Seema, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, I'm just going to ask the obvious question. What is intimate plastic surgery and vaginal rejuvenation?
So vaginal rejuvenation surgery is really an umbrella term that encompasses a ton of different surgical things that women are having done to their vaginas, either with lasers, with scalpels, with injections. It's everything from labiaplasty, which is trimming of the inner vaginal lips, to women having ridges etched onto the insides of their vaginal canals, having skin removed from around the clitoris, having certain fillers put into certain parts of their vagina. It's a whole slew of different surgeries.
Everything about what you're just saying is making me cringe. Every single sentence you just said.
I am sorry, but it's happening.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I know.
The reason it piqued my interest.
As in, like, embarrassed?
As in, no, in pain.
Oh,
in
gotcha.
Total, like, the idea of it is just making me want to.
I so feel like I don't belong in this room right now.
I mean, you raise a good point. I mean, there is sort of a discomfort with talking about it. And why, I mean, we're the professionals. Why are we hung up about it? Or you're not, obviously. And I think it's good that you're talking about it. But why are we so uncomfortable about the subject?
I love talking about all types of anatomy. I have to say, it's fascinating. There's certainly a taboo around genital parts, and much more so when it comes to women's bodies.
Right.
I mean, even if you look at erectile dysfunction or low T, you know, low testosterone syndrome, those things might be difficult for people to talk about, but they'll talk about it when it relates to men, not so much
That's
to women.
True.
And one of the interesting things I found while reporting this story was speaking to surgeons who do vaginal rejuvenation surgery, who said, well, why is it okay for us to talk about bladder and bowel problems that happen to women after childbirth, but when it comes to women's sexual dysfunction, people don't want to talk about it? On the flip side, though, are health advocates who are saying that we're just pathologizing things that are normal about women's bodies.
There does seem to be a double standard at work. You know, you hear erectile dysfunction ads on sports radio stations, and then, you know, you hear the phrase vaginal rejuvenation, and all of a sudden we're like, what's that?
Are they comparable in your opinion? Is it comparable to put, you know, Cialis commercials in the same conversation, or are they just very different things?
I mean, they're treated differently, I suppose, but they are comparable in that sexual dysfunction happens to everyone,
right,
whether you're a man or a woman. But it's interesting seeing the amount of discussion that happens around men's sexual dysfunction and not so much around women. And that's what a lot of these surgeons and practitioners of these surgeries were saying.
Right, yeah.
Well, and the headline, too, is that the number of procedures is up dramatically. I kept thinking about how if this was a New York Times trend story, it'd be, you know, here's the hot new surgery, you know, it would have some clever double entendre headline like lip service or something.
It would be in the it would be in the Sunday Style section.
Right, completely. But the numbers back this up, right?
Yeah, and that's exactly what piqued my interest to begin with, was a report from the American Society for Aesthetic Plastic Surgery that said labiaplasties, that surgery to trim the inner lips of the vagina, were up 49% between 2013 to 2014. And they were only taking a snapshot of what was going on in the country, not even talking to every single practitioner. And just from their data, they found that about 5,000 women had the surgery in 2013, and it's more than 7,000 had them last year. And so that's what made me think women are doing this. They're obviously having some kind of discussion about it. We need to have a bigger discussion about this issue.
I'm curious if in your findings, is it mostly for practical issues of comfort, discomfort, things that come with age or experiences, or is it a lot of people just doing it for cosmetic? I mean, it's a very different kind of plastic surgery if we're going to lump it with that.
People are doing it for both reasons, cosmetic and medical, and sometimes the same woman might be doing it for both as well. So the woman, Margaret, who's featured in our Dallas Morning News story about this issue, said that she was doing it for a medical reason. She had had 4 children, felt that had taken its toll on her vagina, and so she went to a surgeon in San Antonio, who's also featured in our story, and she had the surgery for those reasons. Margaret loves to exercise, one of her favorite hobbies, and for as much as she exercises, she said it was just really difficult having labia that were larger than she would have liked and that had been stretched by childbirth. But then there are other women who say, I want to look a different way. And that's really controversial, because there's one study that showed about a third of women going into a plastic surgeon's clinic will say, I want vaginal surgery because my partner wants me to have it, or my partner said something about it. So that's hugely controversial, especially amongst health advocates.
I'm interested in this from a journalistic perspective, especially a Dallas Morning News perspective, because I don't see this story running in our paper maybe even 2 years ago. I'm wondering if there's pushback, because, you know, I was talking to your editor, Tom Wong, about this, and he's like, this is a major deal for us to run a story like this. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
So I love this journalistic aspect of it, because I was clueless. I had no idea this was going to be a big deal. To me, I'm pitching stories all the time. Sometimes they're about diabetes, sometimes about foodborne outbreaks, and then sometimes about vaginal surgery. I mean, it's a real-life medical issue. It's a public health issue. Women are doing this, so we should write about it, shouldn't we? I had no idea it would be such a big deal, that it might cause any kind of controversy, or that it might take us a lot longer to run it than I had anticipated, because we wanted to be really careful.
You said controversy.
I did not.
Yes, you did.
We can change that in the editing.
I will say, I was in a news meeting where it came up, and there was an editor who said, you know, he it was a male, by the way, said he was uncomfortable a little bit with it. He didn't stop it and say we shouldn't do it, but it is interesting.
And, I mean, the controversy itself is related to sex. I mean, we're not worried about writing about, you guys aren't worried about writing about surgery necessarily. It's the sex that we're really worried about.
It's those buttons that push us.
Right. Yeah.
I think it's sex, but I think it's also about women's bodies.
Mm-hmm.
People have a real issue of giving women a voice when it comes to talking about these kinds of things. And I sometimes wonder if that's driving the increase, if it's because we're not as open as we could be. And that means that women suffer in silence or they have anxiety on their own about how they look and how they feel. You know, I used to work in a hospital in East London. When I worked in the sexual health clinic, women would come in routinely and say, I want to have a checkup, and it's because my boyfriend or my husband said something's not right with me down below. And we do a full exam and everything looks great. That they have this idea, this anxiety that something's not right because someone's told them they don't look a certain way, or they've read a porn magazine or seen porn on a video and they don't look like the women in those.
And what? That's a concern I had too, is it's body shaming in a way, is what it feels, what it worries me about it, that, you know, there's that moment of you think you're okay and then suddenly something from society, something in the magazine, the porn magazines, whatever, feel like you're not. I mean, think about like white teeth. Like, people used to have just sort of normal, natural, bone-colored teeth. And then suddenly you had to have bleached teeth. You know, it's like suddenly you weren't okay. You had to do something.
And what a strange double-edged sword for women, too, that our bodies are the subject of so many conversations, and yet we're not supposed to talk about it.
Absolutely. And some of the feedback that I've gotten has been especially from male readers who have sent emails saying, this is disgusting. I felt nauseated reading this article while I had breakfast. In the next paragraph, they'll say, but I powered through and I learned a lot.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah. So there's been really interesting reader feedback.
We should say there's some pretty specific visuals that go with it that Troy Oxford did on staff.
Oh, we have a fantastic artist here at Dallas Morning News. Yeah, you mentioned Troy Oxford did some, not just pictures showing what anatomy looks like and what kind of procedures you can have done, but he did an animation that really breaks it down what the surgeons are doing. And I think even just those kinds of things, being aware of what's down below, what can be done, what surgeons are doing, is really helpful. It kind of gets that discussion going.
One concern I wanted to weigh in on is whenever we make something trendy, it makes me nervous because people want it, and people who can't afford it will then cut corners to try and get it. So I get worried about suddenly this is the procedure they have to have, and it makes me think of recently in Dallas when we had the woman who was accused of performing illegal butt injections in Deep Ellum. You know, and why? Because Beyonce, Kim Kardashian, suddenly having junk in the trunk is sort of the thing to have.
And there were deaths in that story as well, we should mention.
And so, I don't know, that always makes me a little uncomfortable. We had the Kylie Jenner lip challenge that was happening, people trying to puff up their lips to look like Kylie Jenner. I worry about when we make something trendy and faddish, because also it comes and goes.
Well, we didn't try to make it trendy at all. In this article, we try to put forward the facts in an informative way so that people are aware of what's happening. I think the truth is, it is happening. A 49% increase is absolutely massive. And if we're not the ones talking about it, then there are others. There are others who are advertising it, who are touting these kinds of surgeries and treatments. And so it begs a question, where does a woman go if she wants more information?
Let's talk about you for just a second, Seema. You are a former disease detective at CDC. I guess we're curious, what does that mean exactly, and how did you come to join us ink-stained wretches? I mean, we were kind of just, you know, here one day, and we're like, oh, we hired a doctor. So all of a sudden, we're like, oh, maybe we're not so bad here as daily journalists. Maybe the field is growing because doctors are coming into the newsroom.
I love journalism, and I'm always drawing parallels between medicine and journalism. There are many parallels to be made there. I worked at the CDC as an officer in the Epidemic Intelligence Service, which people call disease detectives, and we were just sent out all over the country, all over the world, to deal with outbreaks. So Ebola is the one that comes to mind right now. Hundreds of disease detectives from CDC were deployed to West Africa and to Dallas to deal with the Ebola crisis, and that's some of what I was doing with many different diseases.
And how do you like being a daily journalist after living such a different kind of life?
I love journalism.
Before doing this,
I don't see it as that different, I have to say, Chris. You know, the things that I really enjoyed about medicine and about being at the CDC was you get to be really nosy. You have a license to ask people as many questions as you want. And, you know, you have a kind of a reason to do it. You're trying to help them. And now you're just trying to explain things. And I'm a naturally curious person. So being a journalist, to me, again, feels like someone giving me a license to ask as much as I want about everything.
And you get to talk to Anderson Cooper a lot more.
I love Anderson Cooper.
Tell him hi for me.
I will do.
So I had one last question. Is there a final frontier for plastic surgery? Is there a body part that cannot be enhanced, or have we now gotten to them all? What is the next hot new body part?
I don't know what the next one is. Even watching Botched last night, there were things that shocked me in the after show. There was some kind of vaginal steaming thing that you can do.
That's true. Gwyneth has been steaming body parts.
They have that at the Korean spa.
They have that at the Korean spa, the vaginal steaming.
At King Spa.
Yeah, you can see it.
Fascinating.
Should we go as the podcast and just go do it?
Can you guys do that?
Well, we could steam other things, right? I don't know.
No, you can actually do the same for other body parts too. And this is why I wanted to be a journalist, because now we have a reason to go to the Korean spa and perhaps try this out so that we can write about it.
Ugh. I'm going to steam my ankle.
Get ready for the next interactive.
Because it's kind of hot. You can read Dr. Yasmeen's story complete with an online interactive and a video at dallasnews.com. Yasmeen, will you also hang out and tout with us?
Definitely.
Did I just call you Yasmeen? Dr. Yasmeen. That's so
you kind of
sorry,
sassed
we'll
it
let
up.
It slide.
So unprofessional of me. Thanks for joining us. See you, Monday. So that last piece of music at the very end, you need to imagine some dinosaurs walking around and doing bad stuff, because that's from Jurassic World, the trailer. Good times. That's one of the big old summer movies that's about to come out. Summer's here. It's not really here, but for the movies, it starts at the beginning of May. Their calendar's a little bit off. They start getting that cash whenever they can. A lot of superheroes, a lot of cringeworthy catchphrases, a lot of retreads, a lot of sequels. It's just kind of the silly season for movies, and you can tell I love it. It's my favorite. Woo!
Because we're in the same halls together, I've already heard you complain about all the sequels and reboots. So what is actually coming?
Oh, I don't know. movies? new Road Warrior movie, which is actually supposed
to
be very good.
I'm actually really excited about
that. That's been getting great advance reviews. The new Mad Max Fury Road, which I'm actually seeing tonight as we tape this podcast on Wednesday.
Is it a screening?
It is a screening. You know, they just go back to the same well over and over again. There's Jurassic World. I mean, do we need another? Why are they still messing with the dinosaur DNA after everything that has happened? Have they learned their lesson yet?
No.
Quit playing with the dinosaur DNA.
That's the only sequel, reboot, whatever that I'm excited about. It looks kind of
That's like the new no, don't go into that room. It's don't play with the dinosaur DNA.
So is that going to be the worst one you have to see?
No, I'm sure there will be much worse than that.
It already sounds cheeseball to me. It's like, here's the theme park, the dinosaurs are loose, here's the love interest, we have to save whoever.
But isn't that the point?
I guess for your popcorn and an hour and a half.
Not all that fond of the point at this point, I guess.
I mean, I hate to say least common denominator. What is least common?
Oh, you can say it.
Yeah, no, that's kind of what it is.
They say it in their pitch meetings probably 20 times a day.
But I think that can sometimes be fun.
It can.
You're just sick of it.
I am sick of it. Okay. To me, this is the least interesting time on the movie calendar. Between January and whenever summer starts now, which I guess is the beginning of May, according to the movies, you have some sort of oddball festival kind of films trickling down. You have some stuff left over from last year that didn't get wide distribution. In the fall, you get sort of the start of the prestige movies. That can be kind of boring too, actually. But I don't know. I'm just so programmed to say, okay, lots of fireballs and lots of robots and lots of dinosaurs. And oh, there's a Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie, because we need that. there's a new Ant-Man franchise, because everybody has been pining for the Ant-Man movie.
I'm superheroed out.
Maybe that's why I like the dinosaur angle, because he's not wearing tights.
You're just not going to let go of the dinosaurs, are you?
I'm excited about Jurassic World.
You know, what bugs me on sequels and reboots is it's become such a formula. Let's take the basic premise, but let's cast it with really hot 20-year-olds and just strip it down to the bare elements. And just none of the soul, none of the craftsmanship that went into the original project ever translates.
But yet
we watch and we go, because I always want to recapture that magic of, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why can't we get it right? What is a good sequel?
That's a really good question.
Have there been any?
Sure, there have been. The Godfather 2 is pretty good. There have been some more recently. than that. Let's listen to a couple of the films that are coming out, clips from one of the films that's coming out, according to our great
I hope there's a dinosaur in there.
Engineer Brian Ellis. There is a dinosaur, in
Excellent.
Fact, because this is, in fact, from the trailer of Jurassic World.
Oh my God, look, it's the dinosaurs from the theme park. They've gotten loose. Quick, hurry, are you my love interest? Help me, we can do this. Wait, here's
Ooh,
the big climax.
Save me from the dinosaur.
We're gonna win.
There's dialogue coming, I swear.
Oh, the world is saved, but I think one still got loose so we can do another sequel next summer.
Okay, see, that would actually be way better than the actual clip we were going to hear, which I think...
that I would have paid money to go see.
Which I think just has Chris... Oh, here we go. Now we're talking.
Oh, yeah.
In the clip, there's a dinosaur jumping from a tank.
Yes.
And catching a...
Like an orca.
Yeah, and dino orca. ...from genetics than a century of digging up
bones. A whole new frontier has opened up. Is this a 20-year-old who's supposed to be a scientist?
Yes, she's very hot. She's got red bangs, you know.
You just went and made a new dinosaur? Probably not a good idea.
Here comes the catchphrase.
Almost 40 feet high. Really think she climbed out? Depends. On what? What kind of dinosaur they cooked up in that lab?
When did Andy from Parks and Rec get so good looking?
Chris Pratt?
Yeah.
Did you see Guardians of the Galaxy?
No.
He was kind of hunky
yeah.
in that
yeah.
as well. So, yeah, there's the dinosaurs. There's some good stuff coming out, too, though.
It just seems topical. That movie seems topical. I'll drop it in a minute. But that movie seems topical with all the SeaWorld drama that's going on to kind of have the animals revolt in a way.
That's a good angle. I mean, Planet of the Apes has been rocking that pretty hard the last couple of movies, too.
Yeah.
So kind of aside from the
just gave me an idea for a trend story.
You're welcome.
So aside from the trend story, I am excited about Mad Max. I want to see that. But is there like a thinking person's film? What are the substance films coming?
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be a few smaller, you know, and I don't want to say that small equals good because there's some really bad small films out there, too. But there's a few things that I've already seen. There's a few things I really want to see. There's a charming film coming out called Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. Mm-hmm. Which was at Sundance. I kind of think of it as a slightly smarter, more mature version of The Fault in Our Stars. Mm-hmm. There's a great documentary coming out this summer called The Wolf Pack, which played at the Dallas International Film Festival. It's about a group of siblings in New York on the Lower East Side, who basically mentally ill father who hasn't let them out of the house for years, and they just watch movies. So they reenact all of their favorite movies with just uncanny precision.
Sounds like Grey Gardens goes to the Lower East Side.
I've talked to you guys about Love and Mercy, the mm-hmm. Brian Wilson Beach Boys movie. I'm a big fan of that. And I am dying to see the NWA movie straight out of Compton. Because that's my
right,
childhood rock and roll. That is what, you know, whatever you could listen to. I mean, it was hard to piss off my parents with anything. But if I did have parents that were shockable in any way, then NWA would have been what I was listening to back then. It was what I was listening to back then. They just didn't care.
What will the parents take their children to? Or what
apparently
should,
Jurassic Park.
Is that rated?
I don't know. What, PG-13?
Probably PG-13.
We should stop talking about Jurassic World.
There's a new Pixar movie.
Okay. What? Wait, really?
Yeah. What's it called again? Is it Inside Out? Why am I asking you, Chris?
I don't know. I'm the least qualified.
I'm the movie
to know
guy. It sounds really fun. I mean, Pixar is generally very good. Basically, the premise actually is really interesting. I hate the word interesting, even though I just used it. A little girl has all these emotions, and each emotion is a character. And Amy Poehler plays Joy.
Oh, well, I'm in.
Just has,
I'm
to,
in, yeah.
has
yeah.
to be fun in
I'll
some way.
I'll survive the horrors of children to see that movie. That mm-hmm. sounds good.
There's a new Minions movie. I love me some Minions mm-hmm. from Despicable Me. Everybody, see, they finally figured out that the Minions were the draw for Despicable Me, and they said, screw it, let's just make a Minions movie and get rid of all of the non-Minions. So I think that's a good call.
We'll make more money. They did that with Madagascar a few years ago. They mm-hmm. had were they lemurs?
Yes.
Yeah.
I will say yes.
Okay. We don't know.
To that question.
I'll set that one out.
And if you want to, please do. You can read my summer movie preview in this Sunday's Dallas Morning News and online at dallasnews.com. I will go into greater detail about a lot of the stuff we just mentioned and be a little less condescending in print. So please read that. Let's move on to our touts, the portion of our show where each of us recommends one thing we are reading, watching, clicking on, listening to, or just plain obsessed with. Let's start with Lauren Smart. Lauren.
Okay, so mine this week is a book I picked up a few days ago called The Wall Creeper. It's sort of a book about a young couple that ends up in Germany and Switzerland, and they sort of unwittingly become eco-terrorists. And it's by an author named Nell Zink. And this is what I think is fascinating about this story, is that she actually was not really discovered in the literary world until she was about...
She's 50, right?
She's 50, yeah. She started... she had sent some letter to Jonathan Franzen, and he...
It's always good to have a friend, be friends with Jonathan Franzen.
Well, no, so she...
Just not Facebook friends.
Right. She just wrote him a letter for an organization she was working for, and he liked her writing, and they just started corresponding about birding and writing. And he made her start writing him stories.
That's
and
crazy.
So
he called her on his dial-up phone and then sent a passenger pigeon over to her window.
So it pays to stalk your literary
if you're good.
Idols.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, she's got a book coming out later, a debut novel coming out later this year. But this is her first, it's not technically her debut, but The Wall Creeper is just beautiful. And she's an author you're eventually going to need to know. So
awesome.
Yeah, sounds amazing.
C-Dub. Can I call you C-Dub?
You may.
Awesome.
Yes, CV. I really loved a story in the New York Times Magazine on Sunday by John Herman. I'm sort of an insomniac, and so is John. And so his version of free Ambien is to listen to his iPod and consume free audio. His drug of choice is old-time radio. In particular, he loved a radio show called X-1. This registered with me because I'm coming out of the closet as a devout old-time radio fan.
It's about time. We knew it all along.
It's very geeky. I don't talk about it a lot, but I love old radio shows. And so I want to recommend, I want to tout one in particular. This is your gateway radio show. If you haven't dabbled before, start with this one. It's called Sorry, Wrong Number. It's by Lucille Fletcher. The story essentially is about an invalid, a woman in New York City, who overhears a murder plot on the telephone.
Ooh.
It's very short. It's very intense, very suspenseful. It aired on the radio series Suspense in 1943. Orson Welles called it the greatest single radio script ever written, if that matters to you. But it's really tight. It's interesting. Lucille, by the way, her husband was Bernard Herrmann, the composer who wrote the score, of course, for Psycho and many other films.
There we go.
Yeah. So, you know, they had some interesting dinner parties. But Sorry, Wrong Number. Check it out. It was made into a terrible movie with Barbara Stanwyck. Ignore that. Go straight to the radio.
Is it terrible? Is the movie bad?
It was fine. Just the radio play works so much better. It's the theater of the mind.
Well, even Barbara Stanwyck could.
Yeah, she can pull off anything.
Save it.
Yeah. It's just, I didn't. I was committed to the radio show. The movie didn't do it for me.
Right. Sarah Heppelow, what would you like to tout?
Well, I would like to do something that is Dallas specific, actually, because I was thinking about what made Dallas a better place to be an adult in than when I was growing up. You know, this city has evolved a lot. So I wanted to talk about a restaurant. I went to this restaurant on Saturday night called Stock and Barrel in Oakland.
Yeah.
And I loved it so much. And I had such a magical night. And the reservation wasn't until 9 o'clock. And so my friend and I had a couple, like an hour to burn, and we just walked around Bishop Arts. I know this is not news to anybody, but at the same time, even though I know that area, it was so cool to walk around, go into these shops, have this really cool, connected urban experience. I don't live in Oak Cliff, but this is always the kind of experience I wanted to see from a place like Dallas. And I loved that restaurant. Everything was good. The wait staff was awesome. The interior's beautiful. The food is amazing. So if you haven't been there, it's a great reason to go out to Oak Cliff.
Did you have the Brussels sprouts there?
I totally had the Brussels sprouts. So good. Were amazing.
So delicious.
If you go, allow an extra 30 minutes to park, though, because that place is hopping now on the weekends.
Yeah.
I love it.
Seema.
Another restaurant called Cafe Momentum. And I don't just want to tell the restaurant, but also the guy who founded it. Yeah. I mean, Chad Hauser, who is executive chef and co-founded Cafe Momentum, is a phenomenal guy. And you can go there and just have amazing food and a great experience because he trains and hires young men who are considered by the state to be throwaways, kids who've been involved in the juvenile criminal justice system who are now having their lives transformed because of him and the opportunity he's given them to learn not just about cooking, but about working and socializing in general. So excellent food and an excellent cause.
And a social mission.
Absolutely, really. And it's doing really well.
Been meaning to get there.
That's good.
I am the final touter, aren't I?
Tout away.
The last wood goes to me. So yeah, I have a skeleton in my closet. I used to be a deadhead. As a very, very young, I was like a 13-year-old.
Yours
deadhead.
Is a lot cooler than mine was.
So I was like, yeah, I have this weird family connection. So I used to get backstage when I was like 12, 13 years old at Grateful Dead shows. Yeah,
that, so that's a good reason to be a deadhead.
It'll be in my book, believe me.
I don't even know who you are anymore.
So anyway, their big 50th anniversary shindig is going down this summer, doing a few shows in Chicago and a few shows in the Bay Area. In Santa Clara, I believe.
Going to be hanging with the band?
No. My days of doing that are long over. I mean, I was just, I was this little pipsqueak kid. They're like, there's a kid backstage. That's interesting. So let's give him some acid. no, I was already doing that. So anyway, there's a couple of books coming out. One I like a great deal. It's called So Many Roads. It's I think it's a great job of separating the mythology and the music and who these people were, and their flaws, and what made them exciting, what made them a major pain in the ass at times. It's by David Brown, who writes for Rolling Stone. He's written some other really good books. Wrote a great book about the sort of Laurel Canyon, L.A. music scene of the 60s and 70s. So it's called So Many Roads. It's giving me an opportunity to sort of reflect back on some of my misspent youth, and I'll be writing about it in the near future.
Nice. That sounds great.
So we don't have any Grateful Dead music. And that's probably...
I know. Why don't we have a Grateful Dead song queued up?
It's because we're not...
Or Jurassic Park.
We're not quite that...
Jurassic World.
We're not quite that advanced yet. But you will find links to some of the things we've talked about today on our show page at guidelive.com, the entertainment website of the Dallas Morning News. Leave us a comment there or drop us an email at mixedmedia@dallasnews.com. Look for us soon in the iTunes store where you can subscribe to the show. Mixed Media is engineered by Brian Elledge and produced by Christopher Wynn. We'll be back next Thursday with Episode 3. Until then, for Christopher Wynn and Lauren Smart, I'm Chris Wagner. We thank you for joining us.